Well, my guest in the studio tonight has spanned a broad range of contemporary musical styles, and he's widely recognised as an important voice in Australian modern music. Based in Sydney since 1986, he previously spent 25 years in the US working with many of the world's top jazz artists. His compositions include orchestral music, woodwind, percussion ensembles, electronic and choral works, and he's been recorded and performed by a range of jazz and non-jazz performers as well. Attracting many awards and honours over his lengthy career, in 2014 he was awarded the Don Banks Music Award, the most valuable individual music award here in Australia. In 2009 he was inducted into the Bell Awards Australian Jazz Hall of Fame, and in 2003 presented with the New Zealand Order of Merit. In a 2010, a biography of his life and career was published, entitled Serious Fun, The Life and Music of Mike Nock, and he was the director of Naxos Jazz from 1996 through to 2002, where he oversaw the production of more than 60 internationally released CDs. Mike Nock, welcome back to Now's the Time.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Mike, we're here tonight to have a chat about celebrating, really, the re-release of the 1960 Columbia recording Move from your trio, The Three, out at that point. How can you describe where you believe your jazz sensibility was back when you were 20 years old compared to where it is today? And of course, the guys, Freddie Logan and Chris Caran.
Well, actually, that's a very interesting question. Basically, you know, it's the same. I mean, you know, of course, I've always been curious, and I've always wanted to check out something and always trying to, like, improve, I put that in inverted question marks, because basically the thing I've found from going back to this music after all these years, and I didn't really think much of it at the time. I thought, you know, and I could never understand. I mean, I just did it and didn't think too much about it, you know. Coming back to it, and because of this gig coming up, actually, that's another story. But because we've got the gig coming up, I figured, hey, it'd be a good idea to revisit that music. That's what the whole thing was about. And revisiting the music, it's like, it's kind of blowing my mind. I mean, it was the first record I'd done. I wasn't a very good pianist, I felt. I really didn't play very well, all that stuff. It was like quite a struggle for me. The whole thing, nerves, not being a very good piano player.
Is that a point of view you've taken from now, or how did you feel at the time about it?
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's how I felt then.
Yeah.
When I listen to it now, I think, well, first thing, gee, it's pretty good in play. I mean, look, I can see what's wrong with it. Don't get me wrong. But also, this is really a microcosm of who I am today. All the things that I do pretty much are contained in that very first recording. I mean, the thing about this music, if you're really a jazz musician, you're playing yourself. So, you can't go home again because you already are home,
that's
no matter
right.
where you are. So that's basically it. I mean, of course, I've experienced a whole broad range of music and experimented with all kinds of stuff and always tried to do certain things. But there was one thing about that music that I've often, and when I left this country and kind of got into more modern type things, and even while I was still here, like I started listening to Bobby Timmons, Oscar Peterson, I heard live in Melbourne, actually, for 2 weeks. It was fantastic experience. So I said Horace Silver, Bobby Timmons, and Oscar, and people like that. These were the people that really influenced me, and I was always trying to play that hot jazz. That's what I loved. And our gigs used to be like revival meetings in those. It was really it was insane. Then I kind of got into the more cooler school, and some even more intellectual school or whatever, like Ornette Coleman, still black music, but, you know, and I was always spent my life trying to reconcile those two polar opposites, really. Mm. Well, maybe they're not polar opposites, but they're pretty different. You know, trying to reconcile this thing has always been the thing that I've had at the back of my mind. And sometimes it leans more to one side than the other. When that record was done, there was less of that. That was just what it was. Nowadays, 55 years down the track, it's like, well, I can go over there, I can go over here. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
There's more choices.
At the time, you were developing this sound and approach, really, from what you had heard on records.
Of course.
And a lot of that would have been black music.
Of course. I mean, my favorite music when I was lucky enough to see him play when I was all of 11 years of age was Nat King Cole. Fantastic. I mean, how lucky can you get? And in those days, in the movie theaters, they often used to play little musical interludes in the Saturday afternoon kids' movies, you know. And it wasn't jazz, but there'd be a lot of what they call it, rock, country. It was like country swing, which was very jazz-like.
Yes.
And you could see Nat King Cole and those cats playing,
yeah.
You know. And that really was what it was all about. And the thing is, back in those days also, jazz music wasn't a dirty word. It was actually just another genre of music up there with classical, jazz, and basically, well, pop. Because it wasn't even rock back then.
Yeah,
rock hadn't actually shown us, or maybe it just started. I think.
Yeah.
So there was not there wasn't too much choice musically, and that was actually great in a way. Yeah. I mean, now we've got it's gone the other extreme.
It has. We're flooded with so many different genres, so much content of each.
Exactly.
That we don't really know where to focus, and I've raised that type of idea with a lot of artists that have come on to the program. The kids these days, if they don't like a song after hearing it for like 4 seconds,
that's right,
they flip to the next one.
That's right.
You know, whereas when we were coming through, certainly, you know, I always listened to a full album or at least a side of an album.
Well, of course. Well, also going along with that, if you had a record, you know, like, I mean, even if you didn't like it, you played it a few times. And maybe you would still end up not liking it, or maybe you would it could end up changing your life.
That's right. And you know why? You had to buy it.
Well, that's also true.
You had to buy it. So you wanted to get into it, didn't you?
Well, actually, I was talking to my friend Lawrence Pike the other day, and he was saying that he started buying CDs again lately, you know. And he says, you know, Mike, he says, it's really interesting. When I buy a CD, he says, I tend to playing it more than a few times because I've already spent the money for it. So it's like I've made this commitment. So I'm going to like see what's there, whether I really like it or not.
Yeah.
You know, whereas you listen on with like YouTube and all this or whatever it is, however you listen, it's just like it's wallpaper. There's
That's
no
right.
emotional connection. If you don't like it, move on to the next. A friend of mine back in the States was actually running the ECM distributorship at one point. And he asked me over to his place and he said, hey, man, help yourself. You know, he gave me about a dozen or maybe 20 records, all these old, you know, albums. I took them all home, and there wasn't one record that I felt like listening to again, ever. Well, that's just because spoiled for choice.
Yes.
If he had given me one, any one of those ones, I would have listened to it until
over
I saw what the hell was happening with it.
Move, of course, that album, which was, it was a great seller too, wasn't it,
It
Mike?
Was.
Back in 1960.
It was my most successful recording for many, many, many years. Let me tell you something.
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to talk a little bit about the trio because it was relatively short-lived. You did the follow-up, the Sittin' In album.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you went to London, but everyone went their separate ways. So what happened then?
Well, I mean, I had a scholarship to Berkeley, and my big plan was always to go to the States, you know. So Freddie wanted to go back to England because he was spent a lot of time there, and he immediately started working with Tubby Hayes Quartet and people like that. And Chris was just along for the ride, I guess, and he hooked up almost immediately with Dudley Moore.
Yeah,
so, you know.
Yeah. From the bassist, Freddie Logan. Freddie was a Dutchman, was he?
Yes.
Freddie's no longer with us.
Unfortunately.
Primitive. Tell us your recollections of Primitive.
Well, Primitive's it's in 5/4, which is nothing nowadays, you know, like, but in those days, that was quite a big deal. Don't forget, this is 55 years ago. And like, I mean, I'd never played in anything except 4/4, maybe 3/4 my entire life. And so I remember like I had to play counting all the time with one finger, with one hand, like this. It's five fingers. You know, so I'm playing while I'm doing this all the time because I couldn't, you know. So that was the thing I remember most about that. It was quite challenging, but hey, you jumped in and you did it anyway.
And of course, Brubeck was one of these guys that started experimenting with different time signatures like
That's right.
this. So you would have been hearing a lot of him, I'd imagine, as well.
Well, yeah, well, he was always one of my big favorites. He was one of my very early favorite musicians, him and Bud Powell. Quite different, but that's what it was like then.
This album, I'm fortunate enough to have a copy of the original, which you gladly signed for me a few years back too, and I was very pleased
about
that.
Well, that's worth money.
It's got to be worth money. The album I saw recently was described on the internet as the holy grail of Australian jazz recordings. You accidentally came across one of these original albums for sale for $3,000 US. How does that make you feel? And especially when you're not getting a slice of the action there.
Look, getting a slice of the action is nothing. I mean, it just makes me feel. It's nice. It's nice. Let's face it. It's nice that someone thinks, but it's a collector's item. That's what and it had to be in pristine condition, all that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's It's like collectibles.
Yes,
you ever watch those TV shows? It's nothing to do with anything. It's just that if the thing's in good nick and it's been around long enough, hey.
But don't you think, Mike, that this album has taken on a certain persona of its own in similar ways to Miles's Kind of Blue has?
Well, I have heard from people some pretty interesting things recently about this album, which I didn't know about. So, yeah, I mean, you know. And the reaction has always been, even at the con when a few of my younger students have come across it by accident or whatever, the reaction has always surprised me. It's like, what? You know.
Just for listeners' sake, to describe the album cover, if you're not aware of Move, it's a black and white photo of the trio, and it looks like that possibly was taken at El Rocco.
It looks like it was, doesn't it?
And of course, you've got the shadow of both the drummer and the bass player, Freddie Logan and Chris Curran. You've got the shadows, the Columbia logo, the original Columbia logo on the bottom right-hand side, and this wonderful orange font with a Move in italics in lowercase, and the three out, which is the name of the trio. And I think that adds somewhat to the whole mystique around this album.
But that's where it's from, too. It's almost like jazz noir, if there is such a thing. You know?
What sort of input did you have into the artistic side of the art?
You didn't have any input into anything. In those days, people say, hey, go here, do this. Same with the recording. I had no idea which tracks I chose or anything. You know, we played the songs we played, and we did about 20 tracks that day. You know, so it was, let's do this, do that. They paid the bills, and it was like a whole... That's one major change. Nowadays, we go in and we do it all ourselves. You know,
it wasn't
like that at all.
That's right.
And the same thing with the art direction. I don't know whether Freddie had anything to do with that or not. I have no idea whatsoever. It really didn't concern us. But we did have a bit of a profile in those days, you know, I must say. And that was because jazz was actually much more present. And it was like, as I said, it was jazz, pop, and classical. And so what we did was newsworthy. I mean, we were on the cover of magazines. We were on TV shows and all this kind of stuff. You know, that was like part of the deal.
Mm.
And so we had all these, like, it was like mini pops. It was like a lot of rock and roll musicians are today.
Yes.
You know, you had to do these photo shoots and all this stuff and wear these suits and all this, or whatever the clothes were, you know. They just tell you what to do. You did it, and we were just happy to play the music. I've actually gone back to this album and gone through everything on it, and that's been a process in itself, actually. It's been quite difficult, but it's also been interesting to me because, I mean, for one thing, I have played a few of these songs over the years, you know, not all of them, but some of them, and thought, you know, I never even went back to the record, just made my own arrangements, totally different than the arrangements on the, so I've actually gone back and learnt the arrangements on the record. Now, I'm not going to play them exactly like that tomorrow because it's not in the spirit of the music, but definitely that's going to be the starting point for it all.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely modeled on this particular, and of course it's going to be played how we play today. And it's kind of actually, because we've got a few gigs coming up around the country, and I've decided to take this approach, I've decided to get back into the old practice book that I used to work out of and doing quite some serious practice just for a while. And it's been really, really interesting. Really interesting. I mean, wow, I think, why didn't I do this sooner? My favorite of them all is actually probably Randy Weston's Little Niles. You know, Randy Weston made a lot of records, you know, and I seem to remember him. Maybe it was he either told me this in person or an interview or something, but he was so knocked out because I don't know whether anyone else has ever recorded the song.
Yeah.
It's a great song, Little Niles.
Move forward 10 years, and I saw on your website Bill Evans was doing a downbeat, downbeat blindfold test, and he points out at that point in time, I'm not sure what album he was listening to, but he makes a comment that watch out for Mike Nock. You know, it's only a matter of time before he breaks through. But of course, you were breaking through with The Fourth Way at this point in time, weren't you?
Yeah. It's an interesting thing. I mean, it really is interesting. You know, like, I mean, obviously by coming back to Australia, I stopped a lot of that momentum because, I mean, it's about being in a place and, you know, all the things that come off of that. But, I mean, I never really wanted that anyway. I mean, I like being here. If that makes any sense? You know?
Why not?
Exactly.
Why wouldn't you like being
exactly.
here?
Exactly.
The German label, BE Jazz, is re-releasing in CD form. And, of course, it's re-releasing the vinyl as well. And of course, I think even the Sittin' In, they're re-releasing Sittin' In as
both.
Well.
Yeah.
How did this come about? Did they approach you out of the blue?
Are you kidding me? Approached me. Most of my records get released on CD, and usually I'm the last person to know. Someone will say, "Hey, Mike, did you know your CDs? That record's available now on CD somewhere." That's what happened here. I mean, that's what happens these days. But I mean, But even in the US, that happened to me a few times. I was in a radio station, and the guy put this record on. I had no idea that I'd made it, you know, because what they'd done, I knew I'd recorded, mm-hmm. and it was Yusuf Lateef's record, a thing called Club Date. It was on one of his biggest selling records, Live at Pep's, but they did a second date from the same date. They just didn't tell the musicians about it.
Really?
They packaged it up, put all the tunes on, new tunes, you know, filled it out. So it's been going on for a while. Hey, I'm not one of those jazz musicians that's in it for the money. So I'm happy that the music gets out there and has legs.
Because
that's what it's really all about.
Mm.
And that's what success would really mean to me. It's just a chance to play more music and to get people, not just to play from an ego point of view, but when you feel that you've got something to offer people, you want people to be able to receive it.
Yeah.
That's all. So, hey, if it means more opportunities to do that, hey, by all means.
Well, I'm going to go home tonight and put this back in the safe. Now that I know it's worth US$3,000.
It's been played, though, see?
Yeah, that's
automatically. It's like a new car. Hey, once you've driven it, it drops precipitously.
That's right. I'm speaking with Mike Nock here in the studio tonight, and it's great fun. Now, is there any ideas of actually recording one of these Redux performances?
Well, that has occurred to me. We'll have to see how it goes. Like with anything, you know, we'll have to see how it goes. I mean, the thought's good. Look, I've got so many thoughts about what to do next. You know, there's so many projects I want to do. You know, but that is one I had thought about, and we'll see how it goes.
You mentioned earlier that there was aspects of the music on Move that you weren't, you're a little bit more discerning about now and critical in some. But I read somewhere where you thought you actually played better on the subsequent follow-up albums.
Well, I thought I played much better because I was, in terms of, now that's the interesting thing about that. I mean, as I said, the first album I was very nervous. I was always nervous, but I always used to, you know, I was learning how to deal with it. But I was also a little bit more confident. I mean, it's a year down the track or several months down the track. I've been practicing, I'm more confident. And to me, I sound much, much better. But as I said to someone, you know, we don't often know. What we think is our best playing doesn't come across like that at all.
Yes.
Because of our egos. And sure, maybe we are playing better in some way, but that's not what the music's about. And it took me years to actually see that.
How do you judge the success of your performance then?
Well, I try not to. It's the same things. Does it feel good to me? And basically, you know, because, you know, look, being a judge, as I often am, and I've done a lot of that stuff, hey, people maybe don't get this, but you often, you know, you've got to give marks to something, you know, like whether this is good, this enters into the competition or this doesn't. But, you know, like I tend to kind of go back and visit anything I say like that. And it's blows my mind sometimes. Some things do stand out. That's definitely one, number one or number two. But when it comes to number threes and number fours, they often change places drastically.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Number 10 can be number six, or number 10 can be number, you know, or number six can be number 11 now. It's like, you know, depending on the day and your mood and all this stuff, you know, it's hard to find that stuff that really consistently hits all the bells.
The talent we have in Sydney on the piano, point me to two or three artists that
McMahon.
Yeah, certainly. You know. I mean, he's quite established now. But who's up and coming that you can point to now? The way Bill Evans pointed to you all those years ago.
Jackson Harrison is someone that's actually getting a bit of play these days. You know, way overdue, I'd say.
Mm.
You know, he's a wonderful piano player. But there is so many good, like Marcello Miao is one who comes to mind. He's big talent. Young Harry Sullivan. But there's many, many others. I mean, Steve Barry. I mean, you know, come on. You're like you're going to keep me here all night.
Talking about piano players, it's amazing how many great piano players have come here from New Zealand.
That's true also, isn't it?
Yeah.
Judy Batty used to put it down to the volcanoes. Seriously.
Thanks very much for joining us in the studio, Mike. Once again, it's been a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.